On my good horse I called you, my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune.
The only miracle we're going to get is us. And this conference is really about starting to make that miracle happen. Sophie Scholl of the White Rose Society, who was killed by the Nazis for her resistance, said, "Somebody, after all, had to make a start. What we wrote and said is also believed by many others. They just do not dare to express themselves as we did." So Earth at Risk is a conference about fighting back.
I know good horse amongst the rich ones, how oft times we go there, an unwelcome guest.
You're listening to episode 651 of Unwelcome Guests, Deep Green Resistance. I'm Robin Upton, and if you're a long-time listener to the show, you won't need me to tell you that that was Derek Jensen. If you're new to the show, then you might, because we haven't featured Derek Jensen much recently. I'm personally been very influenced by his thinking, his writing, and I recall the time I sent a copy of his book to a friend who read it in a weekend and said he thought he'd learnt more about the real nature of civilization in that weekend than in the whole of the rest of his life combined. A real scales from the eyes moment. So, if you're new to the show, you may wish to go see Derek Jensen's contributions. That would be unwelcomeguests.net/Derek_Jensen, or you could just click on the link from this show's webpage. Then click on episodes which feature Derek Jensen, and there should be a list of them for you. He was introducing the 2011 Earth at Risk conference, from which we heard Arundhati Roy last week speaking about the determination of the Indian government to force through the rights of corporations, whatever the human and environmental cost. This week we're focusing squarely on the USA. We have three speakers in, I would suggest, increasing levels of militancy. We begin with another regular on the show, Thomas Lindsay, one of the few legal experts whom I really respect for his perspective on the law. He's pretty outspoken. So outspoken, in fact, I had to censor a couple of patches due to FCC violations. He doesn't mince his words, and his understanding of how the law got to be what the law is overlaps quite a lot with David Graeber, what we heard about how the law is based on rights and property, how protecting the rich is not enshrined in simple laws that could be repealed, but on a really fundamental level, essentially the unspoken core of our legal framework. It's encouraging to hear a legal practitioner's view on that, and that he's not a theorist alone. His work is derived from working with local people who want the law to serve them. He hasn't given up on that possibility and is ready to draft ordinances. And yes, increasing repression from the US government could be interpreted as a sign that they're getting concerned about this strategy. So, this is slightly censored, Thomas Lindsay from the Earth at Risk conference in 2011.
Thomas Lindsay is an attorney and the executive director of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, a nonprofit law firm that's provided free legal services to over 500 local governments and nonprofit organizations since 1995. Co-founder of the Daniel Pennick Democracy School, now taught in 24 states across the country, which assists groups to create new community campaigns which elevate the rights of communities over rights claimed by corporations. Lindsay is author of Be the Change, How to Get What You Want in Your Community, which is for sale at the book table. And also, left off in this bio is that people have heard about anti-fracking ordinances like Pittsburgh, and also anti-corporate hog farm ordinances, and Ecuador Constitution has the rights of nature in it. Ready?
Sure.
So how did your work as a traditional environmental lawyer transform into assisting communities to begin to challenge corporate rights and power?
It's a big question. The reason why we transformed from doing conventional environmental law to doing something different was because environmental law just wasn't working. And when I say it wasn't working, what I mean is we were approached by 300-some community groups in the period between 1995 and 2000. And these were groups that were having difficulties, you know, toxic waste incinerators coming in, or natural gas extraction, or coal mining, or the thousands of different issues that communities face pretty much every day. And these folks would come to us and they would say, we don't want this in our community. We want to say no to it. Our idea of sustainable agriculture doesn't include a 15,000 head hog factory farm smack dab in the middle of the community. And we would patiently explain to them that, well, you know, we would like to say no for you as well, but the system of environmental law doesn't allow you to say no. And in fact, in the United States, the law today, as it has been for the past 100 years, is that communities are prohibited from banning legal uses, L-E-G-A-L, legal uses. And so if you have a Walmart coming in, you have a viable downtown that you're trying to preserve, you can't say no to big box stores coming into your community. And it's unfortunate, but conventional environmental law is all built around that. It's like Lierre's slide from earlier about working around the existing system rather than dismantling the system that is. And the fact is, our activism basically works around the system, which says we can't actually decide what happens in our own community. And so what we end up doing is appealing permits and doing the regulatory dance and basically trying to get the corporations to cause a little less harm for the activity that they're trying to put in. And eventually we had a soul-searching year or two where we shut down our office and said we're not going to do this work anymore because basically we're just helping corporations build better permit applications. To put this out or the other in. And it was about that time that we started getting phone calls from a constituency that we were not set up to assist, which was municipal governments in rural Pennsylvania who were coming to the same conclusion that we were about the status of law and wanted to work with us to begin drafting local laws themselves, which would ban factory farms from coming into central Pennsylvania. And pretty soon those ordinances spread, and they spread to things like sewage sludge application on land where folks started banning corporations from doing that in their communities. And eventually we got to a point where communities were passing laws that stripped corporations of constitutional rights within their municipalities. So the transformation for us was very quick. It was like, this isn't working. We decided to blow out all of our preconceived notions about what environmental law was and what it needed to be in some ways. And then these municipalities began leading the way towards a different kind of lawmaking, which in essence now is about seizing municipal governments to turn their lawmaking functions up against the state and federal levels of government to actually drive sustainability in, because today sustainability is illegal under our system of law. And that's the process that we're stuck in. And so that's transformation that we went through, the transition.
So I know you and I have talked about this before, but doesn't the United States Constitution basically prohibit, basically, aren't you wasting your time? I mean, why do you do this if it's all illegal and going to be overturned at the federal level anyway?
It's a great question, and it's one that we get mostly from progressive activists who look at the organizing and say, no offense. I just started writing an op-ed called Illegal and Unconstitutional, because it's what, when these communities say we don't want a factory farm here, the first thing that happens is Smithfield or Hatfield Foods Corporation says, well, for you to say no to this coming in means you're acting illegally and unconstitutionally. Because under our system of law, corporations have rights. And under our system of law, as decreed by the U.S. Supreme Court, that corporations have more rights than the communities in which they operate, for the most part. And so we can accept that status quo, or we can begin moving to change it. And the question is, if we understand that corporate rights and the system of law that we have, which tends to preference corporate decision makers over community majorities, if we understand that that's federally planted, it's anchored in this federal constitutional structure, which for the most part it is. Corporations have been declared to be persons by the courts, which means they have those full constitutional protections. The question is, how do we build a movement that actually begins to dismantle those constitutional provisions and build a new one? And the place where we've come to is that we now have 140 communities in the United States that have passed what some people would, in the conventional legal community, would call blatantly unconstitutional ordinances. And I think that's the beauty of it, because what we're seeing is the first part of a new constitutional revolution in which they're blueprinting what a sustainable community looks like at the local level. And then they're beginning to join hands with other communities across the United States to force that upwards into state constitutional change and eventually to federal constitutional change. So some folks, you know, when they look at the work that we do and they call it a legal strategy, it's not really a legal strategy at all. It's an organizing vehicle. Because when people pass this stuff, and most folks are operating under the illusion that we have a democracy in this country, you know, and if you go into place and say, well, we don't have a democracy in this country, they think you're crazy. And then you say, okay, well, let's try banning factory farms here. You know, okay, we'll take your hand and walk with you as you do this because you think we have a democracy. Let's ban big box stores. Let's ban factory farms. Let's ban hydrofracking for natural gas, which is what the city of Pittsburgh did unanimously, their city council last year. And so in some ways, our organizing is funny because it's about calling their bluff, which is to say, all right, you don't want factory farms here. Let's ban it. We'll help you pass an ordinance banning it. And the next thing that happens in some of these places is that Hatfield Foods sues. They bring a lawsuit against the community, against the municipality. And they say, well, you can't have that law, good people of the city of blank blank or the township of blank, because guess what? We're corporations and we're persons. And what you've done with that ordinance is take our property, which means you violated our Fifth Amendment rights under the Constitution. In addition to that, you violated our Commerce Clause rights, because factory farm production, hog production, is commerce, interstate commerce under the Constitution. And so you can't do that because you're interfering with our Commerce Clause rights. In addition to that, we have a little rule in the U.S. called Dillon's Rule, which says your municipality can't act unless it's been specifically authorized by the state to do something. It's like a parent-child relationship between the state and the local government. And the corporation comes in barrels blazing with those doctrines. And pretty soon what happens is what people thought they had was a factory farm problem, but it actually becomes a democracy problem. It reframes in the terms of rights versus rights. And it's that reason why the corporations have started to back off. So the city of Pittsburgh passed this hydrofracking ban, which also strips natural gas corporations of constitutional rights within the municipality. 48 hours later, the Maine Gas Trade Association, one of the largest in the United States, said, we're not going to sue the city of Pittsburgh. And they said, we're not going to sue the city of Pittsburgh because I think deep down they understand what's starting to happen, that it's a lose-lose for them. Even if they come in and get a court to strike something down, that something else is going to happen within the city of Pittsburgh because we've set the organizing environment now for it. And it's about going on the offense by using these municipal structures to seize them, to actually turn them up against the system of law. And just as a final thing to that, a lot of folks think the problem is the corporation. So you're in a community and Monsanto wants to come in with genetically modified seeds, or another corporation wants to come in. And the community says, we don't want that here because our vision of sustainability means something different than having that come in. What happens next is that the community, instead of running into the corporation first, the Walmart or the Monsanto or whatever, they run into our own constitutional structure of law first. Because everything within that constitutional structure of law is privately enforceable by the corporations coming in. It's not like the Attorney General sues you because you're violating the Commerce Clause. It's Walmart suing you because you're violating the Commerce Clause. And in addition to that, under our system of law, you can get damages from the municipality. So not only overturn the law that they passed, but punish the elected officials themselves for even daring to pass the law. And it's in this system that nobody really questions, nobody really understands how the system works until you're seeing it play out in front of you. And so the long-term goal here is 10,000 communities across the United States who begin to write a new system of law, which takes the constitutional structure, which places the rights of commerce and property over people, communities, and nature, because that's what the constitutional structure does, not telling you anything. But take that and flip it. And actually begin to drive into law the system that actually places the rights of people, communities, and nature above the rights of corporations. And that, I think, is the long-term haul of what you're seeing right now in the United States in these pockets where folks are starting to do this work.
Three things. One of them is that, to sort of summarize, obviously there's a lot more than this, but part of it is that when people come to you, you said they still believe we live in a democracy. Or if you say we don't live in a democracy, they may look at you askance, but then 2 years later,
they're saying we don't live in a democracy, and they're understanding that the Constitution is not democratic. I mean, I can't even say this because it's blasphemy.
I know. It's like, it's heresy.
Yeah. It's George Washington's going to send lightning down to...
Yeah. Or from up.
Or from, yeah.
From up.
And he would never lie.
No.
So the second part is that you said some things that guarantee you will never be elected president. One of which is this thing about the Constitution being not necessarily the most democratic institution that was ever, well, created by God.
Sure. I mean, you ask most Americans, they think we're the only country with a constitution. And there was a poll out, I think, a couple of years ago, which came to that conclusion. But the fact is that, as you rightly frame, the Constitution is a sacred cow within the United States. What's fascinating to me is when people extol the Constitution, they're really not extolling the structural part of the Constitution, the text, the structural text.
Which is really nasty.
Right. They're extolling the Bill of Rights, which people forget, I think, that had to be driven in over the quote-unquote founding fathers who didn't want a Bill of Rights and actually had to be forced in by the states and by localities. And so the Bill of Rights, which we tend to put on a pedestal, was actually driven in by a resistance group of sorts. And the structure, as you say, is not pretty for the Constitution. And in our democracy schools, which we teach across the country, where we train organizers and lawyers and all kinds of folks, we actually take a look at the Constitution and how it got to us. And it turns out one of the things that we don't read about in history books necessarily is that prior to the Philadelphia Constitutional Convention, our very own George Washington, who was shooting lightning bolts from us from below a little earlier, had a problem, which was he was a massive landowner, 63,000 acres of land, Trans-Appalachia. He was one of the largest landowners in the United States. And to develop that land, he needed to put in canals. Well, George was no slouch. He went to the legislatures of Maryland and Virginia to try to negotiate a deal to start a corporation that would actually build the canals to develop his land. And in saying he wasn't a slouch, he didn't just go for a charter for the company. He also asked for a subsidy from Maryland and Virginia to help him build the canals to develop his land. He spent 10 years trying to get that charter. He eventually got it, but he was so pissed off at the legislatures that he came up with a plan and held a meeting at his place, the Mount Vernon Conference was what it became known as, to say we need a super entity that would actually override the states and localities on issues of commerce. And that turned into the Annapolis Convention, which was all focused on commerce, this centralized federal commerce power. And then that eventually was translated into the Virginia Plan, which eventually became the U.S. Constitution. And so a big part of the structure was all about how do we take commerce and clothe it with the highest protections possible under the constitutional system. And that has become not only how do we clothe commerce and property with those protections, but how do we clothe the people who own the property and who engage in the commerce with the highest protections. And that's why when Walmart comes in, they're building on 100, 200 years worth of law. What we see in the open is not as much as what's under the water. It's like the iceberg where you see 25% above and 75% you don't see it's underneath. We've accumulated law over the past 200 years. And the law has come out of the worst of this country's history, like Reconstruction, where we pulled the troops out of the South. Corporations now use those legal doctrines to control us in communities. And so the question is, how do we dig all that out? And how long is it going to take? Because all of it has to be dug out because we have a 1790s plan of governance, which is fairly archaic. It was written to guarantee that we could exploit the natural resources, which were seemingly unlimited across the United States, as quickly as possible. That's what the constitutional structure is about. And God damn it, they did a good job because we're still on the receiving end of it now, and it's worked awfully well. But it's time to jettison that, and it's time for a new constitutional framework. Yeah.
So what cultural shift do you see taking place in those communities?
It's huge. And it's huge because in some ways those communities are beginning to grapple with this concept that not all property is equal. That when they're on the receiving end of a Walmart coming in, that someone's big property coming in to swallow up their little p property. And that's something that we haven't seen before, I think, that division between the two, that kind of class warfare happening between folks that are relatively privileged and other folks that are relatively super privileged. But I think that cut is starting to take place, and it's starting to take place because we're running out of resources. We're running out of, at least in my opinion, running out of easy to obtain resources. And so the corporate boys are coming into places like Pittsburgh and proposing to drill for natural gas under cemeteries in the city of Pittsburgh, Catholic cemeteries. And so the body, when it dies, you know, it pulls oxygen out of every single place it can, even underneath the fingernails. And the corporate boys are starting, and have been for a little while, doing that kind of work that's bringing communities that were previously privileged and safe from this kind of exploitation into a direct line of fire with corporations coming into their communities. And, you know, we talk a lot about corporations, you know, the C word. But it's not really about corporations. It's about a minority of people within the corporate form that have a super system of law that privileges them above community majorities. And so, I don't know about you, Derek, but back in kindergarten, I learned that democracy was about something else other than that. It wasn't about minorities over majorities. It was actually the opposite way around. And what we have right now is a vested system where the interests are the other way around. And that's what people don't necessarily see, because we've been hammered in our heads ever since birth. The founding fathers were the best folks that ever trod the planet, that the constitutional system is the best system of law ever devised by man. All these myths that have been circulating in us for so long, and the only folks we've seen that are able to come out of that myth-building place and actually begin to engage in a real activism, which is very confrontational and very controversial, are the folks that have imminent harm happening to them. And the fact is, more and more imminent harm is happening in places where it hasn't happened before, and that's starting to radicalize populations that we wouldn't have thought would become radicalized prior to this. And just as a final thought on that, our opponents helped this along immensely. So in Pennsylvania, after we crossed 50 municipalities, so 50 municipalities passing these kinds of ordinances, which went beyond just stopping an imminent harm, but actually about deconstructing the system that enabled the corporation to do what it did in the first place, that the Pennsylvania legislature stepped in. And, you know, some would say that when the Pennsylvania legislature steps in, they would step in on the side of the communities instead of the corporation. Some people might say that. Instead, the Pennsylvania legislature passed a law which now authorizes the attorney general of the state to sue the municipalities to overturn the laws that have been passed to keep the corporations out of those communities. So whereas once you were facing off against a Monsanto rep who was coming into the community saying, repeal that ordinance or we're going to sue you, now the attorney general of the state comes into your community and says to you, if you don't repeal the ordinance that you've adopted to stop factory farms or whatever else from coming in, we're going to sue you, not as the corporation, but as the state, using your taxpayer monies to pay us when we pick up the phone and answer the call from the Monsanto folks, that we're going to come in and actually sue you in the name of the state. Right? And so some people said to us, well, that's really bad for your program area. You know, it's really bad for your work. Now the state is shutting you down like that. To which we said, we think it's pretty fabulous. Because in the beginning, people think that it's about the corporation. And it doesn't do any good to tell them that there's a system behind it and it's actually enabling. But when the attorney general stands in your community building, your municipal building, and threatens your municipal officials and says, we're going to sue you in the name of the state, very quickly the problem statement transforms from being just about the corporation to being about this concept of the corporate state, that it's a system problem, not just an errant corporation problem or a corrupt corporation problem or a greed problem. It's actually a systems problem. And that framing is so important when people actually move to take a remedy or to create a remedy in response to that.
A couple of things. One of them is that I read years and years ago that a former head of the state police during the apartheid regime later said that the thing that they were the most afraid of from the ANC was not its sabotage or even its violence, as it was the possibility that the ANC would convince the mass of people to not respect law and order as such.
Absolutely.
Because no security force in the world can stand up to a populace that recognizes that the security is in place because of guns.
Yes.
That leads to the other thing, which is, you know, I came to this realization pretty late, probably in my late 20s, early 30s, but I finally realized that laws
aren't sacred, and that all they are is rules created by rich people to enforce what the rich people want. And that's a pretty simple understanding, but it took me years to deconstruct all of my schooling. And I'm not saying that all laws shouldn't exist. I mean, I think it's great that, and this will get me kicked out of the anarchy club yet again, but I think it's great that laws against rape exist.
Right.
I think the existence of the Clean Water Act is a good thing.
Maybe.
Maybe. Yeah, we could have a serious discussion about it.
Yes, absolutely.
But that doesn't alter the fact that, by and large, laws are nothing more nor less than... Oh, it's like Eddie Izzard does this great thing about the conquest of India.
Yes, I've seen that.
Yeah.
I love it.
But basically, they came in and they said, this land is ours. And the people of India said, the British did. And the people of India said, well, you can't do that. We live here. And they said, well, we have a flag. And they said, well, what difference does that make? And so, well, these are the rules that we just made up. And that's basically how conquest works. It's like the attorney general is like, oh, how do we get Walmart into this community that doesn't want it? Well, yes. Pass a law, by gum.
Absolutely. Which is why you'll never get elected president. The British, when they went into India, created a culture of violence that also supported the need for those laws. So they created an environment that operated to support those laws back home. It's why English common law was used extensively to enable the violence to occur, which was extensive. I mean, the British, when they went into India, cut the thumbs off of all the master weavers in India to keep the folks in India depended upon English textiles. So they cut off the thumbs of all the master weavers. That's the kind of violence that went into colonialism. And it's that structure of law, that English structure of law, which became the U.S. Constitution, because our lawyers were based in English common law. They called it the best system of law ever devised on the planet. And so...
Which they would.
All the law books were English.
Well, no, they would, because it serves their purposes.
Absolutely.
I don't think the people of India or Africa or North America would necessarily agree that it's the best system of law.
Absolutely.
Devised.
I don't think they would either. It's like when people come up to us now and they say, well, the regulatory system is broken. It's not protecting our health, safety, and welfare. And I say, well, maybe it's not broken, but it's working perfectly, because its goal is not necessarily to protect health, safety, and welfare. It's for a different purpose. But, I mean, I agree 100% that the law, as traditionally as it's been used, has been to shield, enable, allow these things to take place. They're not called permits for nothing that the state agencies issue. They permit something to occur that would otherwise be illegal.
Well, I have a great example of that. It's pretty trivial in some ways, but the frogs in the pond where I live are dying from something called saprolegnia. And saprolegnia is a mold that attacks weakened egg sacs. The egg sacs are weakened because the weakened ozone layer allows more UVB to come through. So if I bring the egg sacs into my house, I raise them. And I do this every winter. I'll start in about a month. I'll bring them in the house, I raise them up, and then I release them. And I was talking to somebody at California Fish and Game about that, just mentioning I was doing this, asking for any help, you know, information.
And they said cease and desist.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is the same organization that routinely gives permits to clear cutters, Sierra Pacific, to cut all the land they want. And she was freaking out and saying, you cannot do this. Yeah. And you have to get a permit. I said, great, I'll get a permit. How do I do that? And she said, I don't know. So it was just crazy.
But it's also, just to play on that, the craziness of it. When we did traditional environmental law, which was essentially appealing permits and moving through that process, we had at least several situations where we would catch somebody doing something they weren't supposed to be doing, didn't have a permit to do. And the state agency would actually retroactively permit the activity by fax sometimes. They'd write the permit and send it, and it would come in by fax. And it's that kind of stuff that just says, what a load of shit, this whole... I mean, it's like built on nothing except I say so kind of thing, you know.
Before we get back to the official questions, I have a legal remedy and a technological remedy that I've been trying to push for quite a while. And since you're an attorney, maybe we could actually have this discussion.
Yeah, I think we covered this in our radio show. We talked about
it.
But yeah, it was awesome.
So I have a legal and technological solution to basically all of our problems, which is a very simple piece of technology. It's a radio-controlled cigar cutter. And basically, the law that I want to get passed is that before anyone can put in a process for which they are permitted, like if somebody wants to put in an oil well in the Gulf of Mexico, they guarantee that it's not going to leak oil, then you establish that all males associated with the project have to have remote-controlled cigar cutters put on their genitals.
And if they're lying, or if the process doesn't work, I mean, if the oil well leaks, then bzzz.
Yeah. I'm with you.
It would solve all the problems. Do you think we'd get Pittsburgh to pass that?
Yeah. Maybe we could patent it.
This will work both ways.
Yeah.
And if we were actually rich, we could get a law that would enforce this.
Absolutely. Or regulate how it's applied and then what current runs through this.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so let's go to Pittsburgh. What drove Pittsburgh to become one of the communities that's doing this?
Hydrofracking. Hydrofracking for natural gas, which is the new frontier for natural gas extraction. Previously unobtainable assets, gas deposits, are now being opened up by this process called hydrofracking, which uses millions of gallons of water to force down boreholes and then blow apart the ground in these places where they horizontally drill. They can horizontally drill now, so the borehole goes down vertically, and then it can go horizontally as much as 2 miles. And along that path, they actually explode the ground underneath to obtain the gas from the shale rock. They use the massive amounts of water to flush down to actually break open the shale rock as well and then force the natural gas back to the surface. It's an extremely dangerous, environmentally destructive, aquifer-destroying. Folks may have seen Josh Fox's movie Gasland, where folks were lighting their faucets on fire from the residue gas coming up. The water coming back is radioactive. It can't be sent into the treatment plants. We have trucks that haul it away in western Pennsylvania and then open up the back of the truck as they're going down the road and just put the frack water onto the roads. And so it's a tremendous environmental holocaust that's happening now. And there are 10,000 more well permits that are being released over the next couple of years in the state of Pennsylvania, which has become ground zero for this. City of Pittsburgh ran into a situation where they were having gas leases signed by the gas companies for property in the city of Pittsburgh, including underneath the Catholic cemeteries in the city to drill underneath. And one city council member, his name is Doug Shields, who used to be president of the council, came to us and said, I want to stop this within the city of Pittsburgh, and we're hoping that if we do it here in the city that other places will do it as well. And we worked with him to draft the first in the country local ordinance that does a number of things. It bans natural gas extraction within the city of Pittsburgh, period. Not just hydrofracking, but all fossil fuel extraction within the city. In addition to that, it strips natural gas corporations of constitutional rights, including Commerce Clause rights and personhood rights within the city of Pittsburgh. It also invalidates any state permit issued that contradicts the ordinance. So it carves out a preemption vacuum within the ordinance itself. And perhaps the most amazing point at all of them all, of these 100-some places that have passed these ordinances, it contains a secession clause, which essentially says that if any unit of government attempts to preempt this, that it forces the town, the city council, to hold meetings to explore forms of separation from the state, from the unit of government that's actually preempting. Because I think in the end, that's where a lot of this stuff leads. There's two paths. One is, you know, we're going to do this peacefully and 10,000 communities are going to pass stuff and then it's going to percolate up. Or the other path, which is folks are going to start to leave. Because right now we're lending our names to all the bad stuff that's happening by virtue of our non-action and actually using our municipalities to build a new system of law. That's what happens now. Silence is assent. And so these places have begun passing these provisions, which are a release point, which say, we now understand what the system is all about. We don't want to be a part of it. And most times it has to be proved to them that's what the system's all about. But eventually it means leaving. And people ask, well, what does that mean? Didn't we fight a war over that? All this other stuff. And we don't quite know what it means. But the fact that the city council of the city of Pittsburgh voted unanimously to adopt an ordinance that does those things with an issue that began as hydrofracking, I think gave me hope in many ways that other places are doing it. The other place that gives me hope is Spokane, Washington, which put on the ballot a community bill of rights back in 2009.
I need to say, I lived in Spokane for 12 years. It's conservative as hell.
Yes. And in 2009, that bore out. We had a community bill of rights that was 11 provisions big, talked about right to housing, right to health care, right to a bunch of other things. Failed by 24 to 76% in the city. the 24 groups that came to build that shortened it slightly and put in proposed a community bill of rights of 4 provisions. One, that neighborhoods within the city would have the power to say no to things like Walmart coming in, so veto power against big box stores and other types of development. 2, that the Spokane River, your friend in Spokane, actually had legally enforceable rights, so rights of nature in Spokane. That workers would have constitutional rights and rights to collective bargaining within the city. And finally, that corporate rights would be subordinated to the rights of the community. That was the 4th provision. And on Tuesday of last week, after 40,000 ballots were counted in the city of Spokane, we were down by 115 votes. And now it's running 50-50. I don't think it's going to win, but it's that close within the city of Spokane, as you know quite well, the politics of the city.
Are terrible.
And it just blew my doors off watching that take place. We expected another 4 years of having to put it back on the ballot, but I think that
and
says something.
Tons of money went against it.
Yeah, last time it was $500,000. This time it was 150-some thousand. Commercials, you'd wake up in the morning, commercials would be on the television and everything. There's something happening. We don't quite
Tom
know.
Tom Lindsay's going to get your baby.
The dingo ate your baby. Something's happening. It's in the air. And so for a place like Spokane, for 30,000 people to cast a vote to give the Spokane River rights, that's pretty amazing stuff, I have to say. So.
So do you want to talk more about legally enforceable rights and why that's important and how environmental law falls short?
Environmental law has been a big disaster in many ways. It's all end of the pipe kind of stuff. And we get into fights with environmental lawyers all the time. I mean, I have good friends in EDF and NRDC and all the big environmental groups. We now see them pretty much as impediments to change. Those are the folks that are grabbing on the tightest to regulatory and permit stuff and actually giving new life to that kind of system. And it's unfortunate, but community groups rise up to stop this, that, or the other in their community. There's 2 places they call when they pick up the phone. One is to the state, because they think that because the state agency is entitled to the Department of Environmental Protection, that it actually does something to protect the environment. And the second place they call is usually to an environmental lawyer who's with Sierra Club or one of the big groups, whatever. And what's funny is both of those phone calls end up in the same place. The state agency says, well, we're very happy that you want to get involved in determining the future of your community. And in this situation, it means appealing this permit, which means you have to hire a lawyer and get involved in the permit process. So they run you down like cattle in a chute, you know, towards the bottom of the regulatory system. And then unfortunately, what we did for 6 years was what environmental lawyers do today with these groups is that you pick up the phone, you call them, and they say, well, you can't stop it. You can't say no to it, but maybe we can delay it or maybe make it work a little better, you know, so that it causes a little less harm. And they send folks right down the regulatory chute. And they all end up at the same place. And, of course, the corporations sending people to, yeah, the bolt got shot through your head because, you know, factory farm issues, for example, suicide among farmers is now the number one cause of death for farmers in the United States, non-natural death for farmers in the United States. There was just that article about India in the paper a couple weeks ago about suicide in India, that people are losing generations-old farms, and they're killing themselves. So communities may be concerned about the economics. Family farmers are getting driven out. They may be concerned about the environmental impacts. They may be concerned about the democracy impacts. I mean, what happens when 4 corporations control 80% of pork processing in the United States, which is the situation today? Well, they gain political power in the legislatures, and then they make more laws, like the ones that we have in Pennsylvania now with the Attorney General's office. So it doesn't matter as a community what your myriad of issues are, how comprehensive your problem statement is, because eventually you get channeled down to this one place where all you can talk about is hog manure, because the state has deemed that the only issue worth discussing is how much liquid manure is put on acre of land once the liquid manure is produced by the factory farm. And so you go into court, your issue may not be manure at that point. Your issue may be all these other things. And you try to stand up and talk about it, and the judge says, shut up and sit down. It's not relevant. The only thing that's relevant now is whether that liquid manure is being applied properly. And so you have to hire your manure experts, and the other side brings in their manure experts, and, you know, you have a manure decision coming out of the judge. But that's all it's about. And so culturally, we're controlled because our activism is not effective because we're channeled like cattle down into that place. And how stupid are we to think that we can make the regulatory system work when it's written by the very corporations that ostensibly it's supposed to be regulating? You know.
You've said that we have not historically had an environmental movement in this country. Can you talk about that for a second?
Yeah, I get in trouble for saying that. I said it at Bioneers a number of years ago, in the same speech where I quoted you and got some feedback from that too.
Speaking of manure.
Yeah. From our vantage point, there's never been an environmental movement in this country because movements are about taking things that were previously treated as property and actually transforming those things that were previously treated as property into being rights-bearing entities. So that's a big mouthful. What does it mean? Well, the abolitionists, African Americans, were property under the law in the 1850s. There was no such thing as murder of a slave. It was a property damage crime. So you paid the slave owner with property damages because the slave was property. Property and you damage the property. In the United States, up until 1860s, 1870s, rape was not a crime. It was a property damage crime. You paid the husband damages. And so under our system of law, we treat certain things as property, certain things as persons. We've never had an environmental movement because we've never talked about the rights of ecosystems or the rights of nature and what that would look like. Nature is property under our system of law. And we've tried to build an environmental movement based on this concept that if you have a 10-acre piece of property, that your deed to that 10-acre piece of property carries with it the legal right to destroy the ecosystems on that piece of property. It's part of the bundle of rights that you have, which comes with property ownership in the Western world.
It back to rape is also historically, if one owns a wife.
Yes.
Then one would have rights to sexual access.
Yes. And for 10,000 years, that's been the law, at least dealing with nature and ecosystems. And what's fascinating to us is in 2001, small borough of Tamaqua, in a small little place in northeastern Pennsylvania, not particularly progressive, had dredge coming in from the Delaware River that was PCB-laden that the companies wanted to dump into old strip mine or old deep mine holes, boreholes within the community. And the community said, well, we don't want that. And so we got involved with them doing that. But they also said, where it's going to get dumped, nobody really owns property near it. Because right now, under environmental law, the only way you get into court is if you have some kind of property interest that's been interfered with so that you have standing to actually go to court in the first place. And they said, well, this doesn't seem right because there are streams there that we fish out of when they go downstream, and we actually use the natural environment, the ecosystems that are in that area where the dredge is going to be dumped. And we said, well, what do you want us to do about it? And they said, well, we want to find a different way to protect the environment. And it was there that the rights-based stuff started. They actually were the first one in the United States to pass a binding local law declaring that nature was not property in their community, but was actually had the right to exist and flourish. So streams and waterways had the right to exist and flourish, and people within the community could stand in the shoes of the river to actually enforce the rights of the river. That's the kind of change that they were talking about. And that was the first place it's happened. And then the folks in Ecuador, who have been used as a cheap hotel for a long time by multinational corporations for drilling and all kinds of other things, heard about what was happening in the United States and actually brought us down to Ecuador to work with the constitutional drafting committee that was put together of these, you know, 300-some people who were in committees drafting a new constitution for the country of Ecuador. And they actually began to write in rights of nature into their constitution at the national level. And we assisted with that, and then it was ratified in 2008 overwhelmingly by the people in the country of Ecuador, making Ecuador the first country to transform from a property-based system of environmental law to a rights-based system of environmental law. And to make the story even more incredible, several months ago, there was the first enforcement action where people brought a lawsuit in the name of the Vilcabamba River in Ecuador against the local government that was building a highway that was impacting the river, and they won.
So I guess two questions, really. One of them is, what do you mean when you use the term collective municipal civil disobedience?
Yes. That's the phrase that's come out of our democracy schools. Collective, nonviolent, municipal civil disobedience through lawmaking, which is, in essence, people seizing their municipal entities to turn them up against the state and federal level, and doing so collectively, because it tends to be our civil disobedience when done individually means that the police come over and arrest us and say thank you very much, and the criminal enforcement system then is used for its full extent to put us away or to punish us. This means moving and evolving beyond that individual civil disobedience to understanding that our disobedience unions needs to become collective, and it actually needs to begin to seize those municipal entities to turn it into the blueprint of law that we've wanted so long to see and that we actually need to put into place. And so somebody coined that phrase coming out of one of the democracy schools, this idea of collective civil disobedience through municipal lawmaking, that it's folks coming together collectively to do that. And just like the four kids who sat in the Greensboro Woolworth lunch counter, they did it for two reasons. Number one, because it was wrong. Segregation lunch counters was wrong, and they felt a moral and ethical need to do it. But second of all, they hoped that other people would follow. And so the next day there were 20, and then the day after that there were 60, and then the day after that there was 300. They didn't know. In fact, one of the kids was interviewed, and he said, "Well, I brought my toothbrush because I knew we were going to be here a while, getting arrested and being in prison." And so I think these municipalities are doing the same thing, which is these communities collectively are stepping forward to say the system of law is wrong, number one. We feel a moral need to do something about it. But number two, if we do it, maybe somebody else will do it. And when they do it, maybe somebody else will do it. And eventually, maybe there's a critical mass that actually drives upwards. Because, again, it's not just the corporations or those small number of individuals in the corporations causing problems. It's a system that enables the corporation to do what they do. And that understanding has to be supplanted by a new system of law that actually brings us into the 21st century.
So this is not my official last question. This is an adjunct. So basically, in many ways, you fit in many places, but one of the places you would fit into Lierre's schema, I mean, you're definitely part of the resistance culture, and then you're part of the building legal alternatives, kind of like when she was talking about in Ireland when they're building alternative court systems to
yes.
supplant the British.
Yes.
And that's one of the places you might categorize your work if you were to choose to do so.
I think so. Our work tends to straddle both. It's about tearing down the old bridge while building a new one, and traffic starts to run across the new one because people are experimenting with these different kinds of things. But there's also more than one way to dismantle infrastructure. And in New Hampshire, for example, there's this big project called Northern Pass where they're trying to wheel energy down from Quebec Hydro to feed the Boston area. And folks in New Hampshire aren't very happy about it, and they're starting to pass laws. We've drafted them. They're going to be on town meeting warrant next year, which actually go a step beyond by saying we're going to prohibit all unsustainable energy systems from running through this community. So actually taking the frame of the NIMBY kind of thing, which is we don't want the power line, but actually putting the power line into a frame where it begins to define what's sustainable and what's unsustainable, and then using that to apply to all kinds of other things, to say we're going to stop that infrastructure from being built before it comes into the community. So I think there's creative ways to use the law that give birth to a variety of different tactics where people begin to understand what's actually happening to them, because I think that's one of the things that has been missing for the past 100 years. The last successful people's movement in this country was the populists at the turn of the century, and they were dismantled pretty quickly. So this generalized frustration that we're seeing today with the Occupy folks, one of the very valuable contributions they've given us is this 99% 1% thing, talking about a corporate class in essence, which I think is immensely valuable as folks begin to grapple with seizing their own municipalities to make law themselves.
So I guess my last question is, are there things that I've not asked you that you want to say?
I don't think so. But it's
thank you very much.
Yeah. I'm billing for the full hour, so. we do a lot of conferences. And those conferences that we do, I've come to a point where I think that they're fairly pointless, a lot of them, because people come to them for entertainment. And the work that we do is not, it's entertaining, it's fun, learning about the stuff, and the democracies are fun, but we're actually looking for the people who are actually going to do the shit now. 10 years ago, we'd go into a conference and speak to 1,000 people, and, it'd be applause, and everybody would be happy, and that's great. But there'd be very few people coming forward to say, I want to do that where I live. And now we don't do anything except those events that are calculated to lead to finding those individual people who are actually going to do the work. And I think that's a difference about how we've transformed ourselves from just trying to galvanize public education to actually finding those individual people that for some reason or the other are as crazy as you and I, to actually think that they can do something to disrupt the entire system and to throw everything back like jujitsu against the folks that are doing it to us. Those people are very precious to us. They tend to be self-confident. A lot of them are kids. You know, we had somebody come 3,000 miles to work on the Envision Spokane campaign, who's now a staff member of ours working in Pennsylvania. And so these folks that come out of these community campaigns, actually giving them jobs so that people can earn a living doing this work. And that's one of the big challenges now, is finding out how to construct that system with enough resources to actually give birth to those folks.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And now we return to Derek Jensen. I think this is how the conference opened. A summary of a lot of his earlier ideas and a rallying call to arms in defense of the planet, which gives us life and supports us.
So Earth at Risk is a conference about fighting back. The dominant culture, civilization, is killing the planet. And it's long past time that those of us who care about life on Earth began to take the actions necessary to stop this culture from destroying every living being. By now, we all know the statistics and trends. 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. There's 10 times as much plastic as phytoplankton in the oceans. 97% of native forests are destroyed. 98% of native grasslands. Amphibian populations are collapsing. Migratory songbird populations are collapsing. Mollusk populations are collapsing. Fish populations are collapsing, and so on. 200 species are driven extinct each and every day. If we don't know the statistics and trends, we should. And by the way, have you noticed that you don't have to clean your windshield nearly as often as you used to? Even insect populations are collapsing. This culture destroys land bases. That's what it does. When you think of Iraq, is the first thing that comes to mind cedar forests so thick that sunlight never touches the ground? One of the first written myths of this culture is about Gilgamesh deforesting the hills and valleys of Iraq to build a great city. The Arabian Peninsula used to be oak savanna. The Near East was heavily forested. We've all heard of the cedars of Lebanon. Greece was heavily forested. North Africa was heavily forested. I'll say it again. This culture destroys land bases. And it won't stop doing so because we ask nicely. We don't live in a democracy. And before you gasp at this blasphemy, ask yourself, do governments better serve corporations or living beings? Do judicial systems hold CEOs accountable for their destructive, often murderous acts? Here's a couple of riddles that aren't very funny. Question. What do you get when you cross a long drug habit, a quick temper, and a gun? Answer. Two life terms for murder, earliest release date 2026. Question. What do you get when you cross two nation states, a large corporation, 40 tons of poison, and at least 8,000 dead human beings? Answer. Retirement with full pay and benefits. That's Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide, which caused the mass murder at Bhopal. Another way to say this is, what do you call someone who conspires to put poison in the subways of Tokyo? You call them a terrorist and you put them in prison for life. What do you call someone who conspires to put poison in the groundwater of the United States? You call them Dick Cheney. Or oil and gas man, fracker. Do the rich face the same judicial system as you or I? Does life on Earth have as much standing in a court as does a corporation? We all know the answers to those questions. We also know that if you allow destructive institutions to continue, they'll destroy your community. And we know in our bones, if not always our heads, that this culture won't undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living. I've asked thousands upon thousands of people of all walks of life, from activists to students to people I've met on buses and planes, whether they believe the culture will undergo that voluntary transformation. Almost nobody ever says yes. So if you care about life on the planet, and if you believe the culture won't voluntarily cease to destroy it, how does that belief affect your methods of resistance? Most of us don't know because most of us don't talk about it. This conference talks about it. This conference is about that shift in strategy and tactics. This conference is about fighting back. We have to put our bodies and our lives between the industrial system and life on the planet. We have to start to fight back. Those who come after, who inherit whatever's left of the world once this culture has been stopped, whether through peak oil, economic collapse, ecological collapse, or the efforts of brave women and men resisting an alliance with the natural world, are going to judge us by the health of the land base, by what we leave behind. They're not going to care how you or I lived our lives. They're not going to care how hard we tried. They're not going to care whether we were nice people. They're not going to care whether we were violent or nonviolent. They're not going to care whether we grieved the murder of the planet. They're not going to care whether we were enlightened or not enlightened. They're not going to care what sort of excuses we had to not act. I'm too stressed to think about it. It's too big and scary. I'm too busy. Those in power will kill us if we effectively act against them. If we fight back, we run the risk of becoming like they are. Or, but I recycled. Or any of a thousand other excuses we've all heard too many times. They're not going to care how simply we lived. They're not going to care how pure we were in thought or action. They're not going to care if we became the change we wish to see. They're not going to care whether we voted Democrat, Republican, Green, Libertarian, or not at all. They're not going to care if we wrote really big books. They're not going to care whether we had compassion for the CEOs and politicians running the deathly economy. They're going to care whether they can breathe the air and drink the water. We can fantasize all we want about some great turning, but if the people, including the non-human people, can't breathe, it doesn't matter. Every new study reveals that global warming is happening far more quickly than was previously anticipated. Staid scientists are now suggesting the real possibility of billions of human beings being killed off by what some are calling a climate holocaust. A recently released study suggests an increase in temperature of 16 degrees Celsius, that's 30 degrees Fahrenheit, by the year 2100. We're not talking about this culture killing humans and indeed the planet sometime in the far distant future. This is the future that children born today will see and suffer in their lifetimes. Honestly, is this culture worth more than the lives of your own children? In The Nazi Doctors, Robert J. Lifton explored how it was that men who had taken the Hippocratic Oath could lend their skills to prisons where inmates were worked to death or killed in assembly lines. He found that many of the doctors honestly cared for their charges and did everything within their power, which meant pathetically little, to make life better for the inmates. If an inmate got sick, they might give the inmate an aspirin to lick. They might put the inmate to bed for a day or two, but not for too long, or the inmate might be selected for murder. If the patient had a contagious disease, they might kill the patient to keep the disease from spreading. All this made sense within the confines of Auschwitz. The doctors, once again, did everything they could to help the inmates, except for the most important thing of all. They never questioned the existence of Auschwitz itself. They never questioned working the inmates to death. They never questioned starving them to death. They never questioned imprisoning them. They never questioned torturing them. They never questioned poisoning them. They never questioned the existence of a culture that would lead to those atrocities. They never questioned the logic that leads inevitably to the electrified fences, the gas chambers, the bullets in the brain. We as environmentalists do the same. We fight as hard as we can to protect the places we love, using the tools of the system the best we can. Yet we don't do the most important thing of all. We don't question the existence of the whole death culture. We don't question the existence of an economic and social system that's working the world to death, that's starving it to death, that's imprisoning it, that's torturing it. We never question the logic that leads inevitably to clear cuts, murdered oceans, loss of topsoil, dammed rivers, poisoned aquifers. And we certainly don't stop these horrors. What do all of the so-called solutions to global warming that are presented in the mainstream, what do they all have in common? What they all have in common is they take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is that which must conform to industrial capitalism. And that's literally insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality. Without physical reality, without a real world, you don't have any economic system whatsoever. Any solution to global warming, any solution to any of these problems, has to take the real physical world as a given, and the social system as that which must conform to the real world. I mean, how do you stop global warming that's caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas? If you ask any reasonably intelligent seven-year-old, which I've done, so I've asked a seven-year-old, so what will it take to stop global warming caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas? And the seven-year-old said, stop burning oil and gas! I said, you are smarter than any environmentalist I've ever met. If you ask any reasonably intelligent 35-year-old who works for a green high-tech consulting corporation, you're going to receive an answer that actually helps the corporation more than the real physical world. I mean, there's another way to think about this, is that, you know, what do you do if your bathtub is overflowing? Turn off the tap, right? Well, actually, no. If you're an environmentalist, what you do is you apply for a grant to the Pew Charitable Trust, and they will then, you use the money to buy a solar photovoltaic system that can pump the water off your bathroom floor out through a gray water system, and then you can use it for permaculture. I've just succeeded in insulting everyone in the room. When most people in this culture ask, how can we stop global warming, they aren't really asking what they pretend they're asking. They're asking instead, how can we stop global warming without stopping the burning of oil and gas, without stopping the industrial infrastructure, without stopping the whole omnicidal system? And you can't. It's like people say, how can we save the salmon? It's actually pretty straightforward. Remove dams, stop industrial logging, stop industrial fishing, stop the murder of the oceans, stop global warming. When people say, how can we save salmon, what they're really asking is, how can we save salmon without removing dams, without stopping industrial logging, without stopping industrial fishing, without stopping the murder of the ocean, without stopping global warming? The answer, you can't. Here's another way to look at all this. What would we do if space aliens had invaded this planet and they were vacuuming the oceans and cutting down native forests and putting dams on every river and changing the climate and putting dioxin and dozens of other carcinogens into every mother's breast milk and into the flesh of your children, lover, mother, father, brother, sister, friends, into your own flesh?